Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Lisa Napoli, and when you're job seeking, here's something you don't want to hear.
Do you even understand what's going on in the world?
That's job recruiter Mark Gentry with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Mark says if candidates don't have a certain attribute, he won't find them work, but he will likely ask,
do you even understand what's going on in the world?
So what's required to get in Mark's good graces? Is it A, an internet presence? Recruiters are looking for people who network online. Or should you have B, a cell phone? I mean, what kind of job seeker can't be reached 24/7? Or do you need C, a business suit, even if the interview is on casual Friday? Give up? The answer's on this week's Marketplace Money, mere minutes away from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Hey there. Will you be my virtual friend? If you say yes, I'll link my page to yours so everyone can see. It may sound like just another way to kill time on the internet, but it turns out you might get a job out of the deal. I'm Lisa Napoli in for Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
I've never counted how many friends I have in the real world, but in the online community of Facebook, I have 75. Now, the people who run these social networking sites don't just think of them as digital popularity contests. They're banking on them doing some good for your career. What got us thinking about this was that MySpace opened new offices in San Francisco this week and said it was hiring 200 new employees. The business of online networking is growing, and part of the reason is that people are using them to recruit and job seek. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson found that just like it is offline, it's less about what you know, it's who you know.
It's a sunny afternoon in San Francisco, and I've asked Mark Gentry to take a break from his day job as a recruiter and join me at the Embarcadero. We're at the water's edge in the shadow of the Bay Bridge with thousands of lunching downtown workers just a block or two away. It's a rare outing for Gentry because he says these days recruiting is done almost entirely on the internet.
A good recruiter is living online.
And he says a good job seeker should be as well because the old way of finding work doesn't cut it anymore.
Right now, if you sent me a resume in an envelope, there's little chance that I'll even open it. And the first thing I'm going to do when I get that is I'm going to look online to see where you are. And if you're not online, then I'm going to think, well, why aren't you online? Are you even current to the market? Do you even understand what's going on in the world?
If you are online, there's a good chance Gentry can find you. He's found jobs for thousands of people after looking at their profiles and the people they're connected to on social networking sites. Sites like Facebook, MySpace, Rise, Zing, and most of all, LinkedIn.
You come to LinkedIn to get business done, basically.
That's the company line from Scott Nelson at LinkedIn's headquarters in the heart of Silicon Valley. The site has 15 million users, and Nelson says it's growing by a million a month. He describes the job searching on competitors' websites as a happy hour,
where you're all getting together, meeting around with, you know, a drink in your hand. LinkedIn is more about, hey, let's go ahead and sit down around a conference room table and discuss it.
So LinkedIn's not a cocktail party. It's a conference room.
It's a conference room, and in some cases, you might have a couple of cocktails with you.
Now, drinks or not, each conference room table can have thousands of people sitting around it. Your connections, people who agree with you that your relationship with them is worth advertising. But Nelson says too many connections can be a bad thing.
You know, it's important to manage your network correctly. And what I mean by manage is not to just grow it out as much as you possibly can. It's not a competition. It's really where the value is. And those values are in relationships that you have.
That's where Mieszek Pisgorski of the Harvard Business School agrees. He's done extensive research of online job hunting, and he says the size of your network is important. Not too many, that means you're spending too much time online or you're being indiscriminate in choosing your friends. Not too few, that means you don't have any friends or you don't care.
Striking a middle ground between, 100 and 500 is probably a sensible thing to do.
But it's not just size that matters, says Pisgorski. Pretending to be off the market is a good thing, too. These social networking sites are filled with what are called passive job seekers, people who are employed, maybe even happy in their jobs, but they'd take a better offer if it came along. And if you're one of those, you're actually more attractive to a recruiter.
If I have a choice between recruiting somebody who's already employed or recruiting somebody who's unemployed, the sheer fact that they're already employed gives me a strong signal that they're basically higher quality.
Pisgorski says the people who benefit the most from the social networking job hunt are the masses in the middle, not entry-level candidates and not senior VPs.
Beforehand, there was just a huge inefficiency in the labor market. People who wanted to look for another job had to rely on their personal friendships. Now I think what you see with these online social networks is that the playing field has been leveled.
And as more companies use social networks to recruit, Pisgorski says it will become increasingly difficult for job seekers to stay out of the online game. In San Francisco, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Daytime television is filled with scenes of lust, betrayal, and soon maybe mutual funds. Turns out Uncle Sam is meeting with producers of soap operas and steamy Spanish-language telenovelas to convince them to insert financial advice into the plot lines. One of the people behind the plan is the U.S. Treasurer, Ana Escobedo Cabral. Ana, of all the places to learn about finance, why daytime TV?
There is an abundant amount of material and curriculum, but what we were perhaps missing in this was to reach people at teachable moments in their lives, whether it's, Spanish language, soap operas, telenovelas, which we had a concept of, or, my early idea way before Friends came off the air was to think of, Joey getting into some sort of financial catastrophe, and then through that humor he could teach at the same time that he was entertaining.
Right. Get people where they learn.
Yes.
Or what they consume. But what you're talking about here with this initiative is to look mostly more at adults and more, again, in the entertainment realm.
Perhaps. But quite frankly, we're looking at finding ways of really reaching people of all ages and all income levels. And that's where the creativity comes into play. It's, you can certainly develop some lessons for teachers, put them online so that they can use and incorporate in their classrooms, and we've done that very successfully. But you also, need to reach college-age kids and high school-age kids, and if you can, preschool-age kids, and you need to reach people, headed toward retirement and in retirement. The messages have to be multifold and targeted to people of every cohort and every income level.
Right. Can you tell me a little bit more about why you think there isn't a zest for this kind of information?
Well, I think that there's more that we can do. Probably a lot of this was taught in the home before, and perhaps we're not doing as much of it as we could do. But, too many kids, for example, are graduating high school not understanding what a budget is, how to balance a checkbook, what a credit card is, what an interest rate is, or how compound interest works. A lot of them are not thinking about retirement. They can't even imagine retirement. But yet, if they'd start early on, even in small amounts, time is on their side, and they'll have a wonderful nest egg at the end of that process.
But you're also dealing, and so are parents, with a lot of competing forces out there and mass media that show you acquisition of big expensive things without any sort of earning going on. So that's got to be a tough challenge for you as you try to work with entertainment properties.
Well, I mean, certainly there's always challenges about getting messages out, but we all learn differently. So you have to find ways in which you present the material so that more and more people can receive it. We're going to have to be creative and we're going to have to be committed. But the great news is that we've got tremendous partners in the private sector. We've got tremendous partners in community-based organizations. And I think that sort of collaboration works. I think one of the things that Treasury's learned is if Treasury tries to do this by itself, it will not be successful. But if you do this in partnership with all of the other segments of society, you're likely to be very successful. And in the end, the public and the entire country is better off.
Gosh, while you're saying that, I'm thinking if there had been a soap opera where one of the characters had gotten a subprime mortgage and gotten into trouble, maybe, we could have saved some of the crisis that we're going through right now.
Well, that's the thinking, is that we can educate through absorbing other people experience things. You don't have to live the drama yourself.
Ana Escobedo Cabral, you are the U.S. Treasurer. Thanks for taking some time to talk to us.
It's great to be with you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Is marriage dumb? We're not being unromantic. That was the question posed in this month's Money magazine, specifically about unions between financially successful people of a certain age. In the past decade, the number of unmarried Americans over the age of 65 has grown by 70%. Sibel Weiser is an editor with Money magazine. Sibel, the story points out that wedded bliss isn't always good for the bank account. What are some of the issues?
Often, people do realize that they're going to pay more income taxes if they get married and file jointly. If you're married, you can be legally obligated to shoulder some big expenses. I mean, you are legally obligated to repay your spouse's credit card debts, for example, or their loan payments. And, you're very likely going to feel obligated to, help with the kids' college tuition.
What about what happens with the issue of kids in a later in life marriage?
This is pretty important if you do want to earmark assets for your children from a previous marriage, because legally your assets will just go right to your spouse should you die. So if you do want to leave something to your children, you need a new will and possibly a trust and, ideally perhaps a prenuptial agreement as well.
Now, for couples who choose not to get married, is there an equivalent of a prenuptial agreement for people in that kind of situation?
There is. It's called a living together agreement. And basically, it works somewhat similar to a prenuptial agreement in that it specifies what expenses and assets you'll share, what happens if you separate. We also recommend that people should certainly have healthcare proxies and medical powers of attorney so that they can make healthcare decisions on each other's behalf. Get some of the same rights that married couples do, like hospital visitation. That's really important for anybody of any age who is living together permanently.
So, Sibel, is there a clear-cut situation where I would be better off not getting married?
Yeah, I think if you are gaining a lot of income from a previous marriage, and either that's through, an ex's pension or alimony, I mean, I think in that case, you're clearly giving up a big chunk of change, and chances are the calculation is going to come down in favor of not getting married.
So the short answer to the question, is marriage a dumb move, is it depends.
It does depend. And either way, there are legal safeguards you can put in place to make sure that whatever you want to happen would happen in the event that you were to separate or one of you was to die. So, either way, you want to just take care that you have all the correct documentation in place.
Sibel Weiser is an editor at Money Magazine. Thank you.
Thank you for letting me be a guest on your show.
Coming up, having trouble keeping track of grandma's investments? Chris helps one family get organized. And looking for a new career? This guy has just the thing.
I was getting kind of burnt out on my job. I decided, hey, I'm going to go try monster truck racing.
A very loud day in the work life of a monster truck crew chief. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Lisa Napoli, in for Tess Vigeland. If you're listening in Cardiff, Wales, perhaps via podcast, here's an idea for a day out, a Munster truck show. That all-American motorsport is touring Europe right now. Next weekend, the Welsh get their first chance to see 10,000-pound cars spin, jump, and crush. So on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we roll with one truck's crew chief.
Our next driver from the windy city of Chicago, Illinois. Let's get loud for George Bellhand and Escalade.
I'm Benjamin Winslow, also known as Bobo, crew chief for George Bellhand's Escalade. An Escalade is a 1,500 horsepower monster truck. Got 24-inch spinner rims on 66-inch tires, purple neon lights, a 1,500-watt kicker sound system, and a lot of attitude. I'm in charge of the setup of the truck, taking care of George, making sure he's happy and comfortable in the truck. I've put this motor in it. I've rebuilt this truck from the ground up. Sometimes I even tell George, I'll say, George, I bet you can't flip that truck, and he'll just try and try, and he'll just tear it up, do everything he can to try and wreck it, and sometimes he just can't do it. That's what I like to see. You know, I want a good challenge. In Las Vegas, George was making jumps, and he was about 60 feet in the air, and on the second landing, the front end came apart on him. It actually pulled 3/4-inch bolts out from the studs. We're going to push this truck to the limits. When I grew up in eastern North Carolina, we'd skip school and go hang out at Dennis Anderson's Gravedigger Racing, Monster Truck Racing Shop. After graduating, I've got my bachelor's degree in ag business from Northwestern Oklahoma State, and I was getting kind of burnt out on my job. I decided, hey, you know, I'm going to go try monster truck racing. We see a lot of strange things. You get some crazy stalker fans out there. They'll stalk you, find you on the internet. It's pretty crazy sometimes. Some of them are pretty cool, though, but it's kind of like we're living their dream. I'm single. I'll be gone for 3 months on the road across the United States. I get to hang out with people like Playboy bunnies, rock stars. It's pretty cool. Over $250,000 have gone into this truck just in parts alone to get it to where it is now. But on a weekly basis, you could be looking at $5,000 a week. You're looking at $2.70 a mile to go down the road, and it's nothing to drive 2,500 miles a week just to get to a show. The spinners, you're looking at about $25,000 just for the wheel spinners. Everything's custom made on this truck. Thank goodness we have an unnamed owner that pretty much says money is no object. Pay scale could start off, depending on experience and education, just under $30,000. I'm looking to be around $50,000. But, you know, it's not really sometimes how much you make. It's if you enjoy getting up and going to work in the morning. I've made a lot of money doing plant breeding and genetic research using my degree, and I just wasn't happy. You can't take it with you when you're gone. That's what I'm trying to say there. So, you know, let it happen, man. Let her rip.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
A federal program that's gone flat brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, COLA. COLA stands for Cost of Living Adjustment, the pay bump you get as things get more expensive. Over 50 million Americans got a jolt of reality this week when the Social Security Administration announced next year's COLA increase, 2.3%, the smallest in 4 years. Experts say energy and consumer goods are getting cheaper, thus Social Security recipients get a smaller sip of COLA. Not much of a consolation for cash-strapped seniors who found the announcement less than bubbly.
Hi there, everybody.
everybody. I'm Lisa Napoli, and this is a time where we turn the mic around and find out what your questions are. With me is Marketplace Money's own financial editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris, how are you?
I'm doing well. It's great to be with you.
It's great to be here with you. Thank you. Before we get to the letters, this is the part where I get to read our website address, marketplace.org. Click on the contact button if you want to send us a question. Or you can call us with a question at 1-877-275-6669, which translates into the best misspelling in public radio, 1-877-ASK-MONY, Ask Money. Well, our first caller is Pete. He's a music teacher in San Jose, California. Hi, Pete.
Hi.
So I understand your question has to do with your mother. She's 85, and you're worried about her finances, aren't you?
Yes. She has two sources of income and one sort of support. It's my dad's medical coverage. After he died, she still has that as a surviving spouse from his pension. She is getting about $1,000 from Social Security, and she owns her own house, and right now she's living in assisted living, and we need to decide if selling the house is a smart thing to do.
And I understand your brother's been going to this financial seminar about increasing wealth and...
I think something like buying and selling options. And, yeah, thinks that somehow he can make her live a comfortable life forever on it or something.
Chris, what do you think about that? Pete's skeptical. What do you think?
Well, I'm extremely skeptical about any of these programs. I mean, if your brother wants to do it with his own money on his own time and he thinks he's going to make money, that's fine. I wouldn't be playing around with any of your mom's money. Here's what my main recommendation, Pete. One of the best things that you and your brother or your other family members can do, because you have this issue about selling the home, we're in an assisted living situation, you know, how much is the money going to last? One of the best recommendations, I think, over time is for the family members to get together, pool their money, I don't know, what, $3,000. And one of you or all of you do some real research, finding a really good certified financial planner that deals with elderly patients and come up with a financial plan. When does it make sense for your mom to sell the home? When she sells the home and she gets a gain, how do you want that gain structured? Where's the money going to go? Is it going to go into some form of an immediate annuity where she can't outlive it, but she gets a payout every single month? And to come up with a really good financial plan for your mom. And what the kids do is they come together, they do the research to find someone who's really good at doing this type of financial planning, and then everybody's on the same page and understanding the same risks, and then you can really help your mom as she gets older and her health deteriorates. The money will be there.
Okay.
Does this help you at all?
Yes, I think it does.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, Chris, now we've got our first email of the day. Nevin is writing in from New York City. Nevin considers himself an educated and experienced investor, and he wants to try to invest in what's known as the frontier market. There are emerging market mutual funds, but they don't disclose how much of their capital is invested in frontier markets. Chris, what exactly is a frontier market? Is that China, or what countries are we talking about here?
Well, people mean different things by frontier markets. I include the big ones, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. I still think they are frontier markets. But to some people, look, those are the big emerging markets, and they're more interested in what's going on in Vietnam, Peru. Peruvian market's been doing extremely well. The Ukrainian market is one of the best performing markets. But the Chinese market, to me, is still a frontier market. It's a frontier economy as it makes its transition from a state-dominated economy to a market-dominated economy.
Gotcha. And while it's difficult, very complicated to buy into those markets as a U.S. citizen, in some cases it's probably impossible, there are ways to get a piece of that action. What are they?
It's a global capital market, and one of the best ways to invest is through either mutual funds that concentrate on the emerging markets and the frontier markets, or exchange-traded funds, ETFs. And what an ETF is, it's an index. But it trades like a stock, so you can buy and sell it on an exchange. There's also iShares is a well-known company that issues a lot of these kinds of shares in the emerging markets. So it's easier for the individual investor to invest in frontier markets than ever before. And, you know, the latest figure I saw was there are now, it's more than doubled. There are now like 124 foreign-oriented exchange-traded funds. So he'll be able to find his find what he wants. And there's one website, etfresearchcenter.com. You can get a lot of information from there, too.
Great. If you are in search of new financial frontiers but don't know where to start, we can help you. Click on the contact button on our website, marketplace.org, or call us at 1-877-275-6669. That's 1-877-ASK-MONEY. Okay, Chris, our second caller has been a little bit too busy lately to keep track of a lot of things, but once you hear her reason, you won't really blame her. Krista is calling from Boulder, Colorado. And Krista, I understand you have a baby, but that's not the only thing that's been keeping you up all night.
No, my finances are keeping me up, and actually my future.
Mm-hmm. I guess you really have a fine point on that now when you have a baby.
Yeah, definitely. It really makes you think about it. And the question I have is that I left my job when I was pregnant, and I had a 401k, and my company was matching it. And that company was Time Warner. I worked for a magazine. My question is, should I leave the money in a plan? I don't know what to do. I don't know much about the stock market. And also, when is it a good time to roll it over? Does it depend on what the market's doing?
You've come to the right place.
Okay. I have a lot of thoughts here. First of all, you have time on your side because you're with a good company that has a good retirement plan. So if it takes you a year to figure out what you want to do, there's no real penalty there. I'm in the camp that believes you take it out of your employer's plan, not because your employer's going to do anything bad, but you no longer work there. If it takes you a year to figure out what to do with this, you can feel comfortable taking that year with a goal. I would say in most cases for most people, it would be rolling it out of the plan into an alternative plan. Okay, so that's the first part. Is it better to do it in a bull or a bear market? Here's the Chris Farrell guarantee. When you make the move, the market will fall by 500 points. It will be 1987 all over again. I guarantee you. Nevertheless, you make the move, okay? Because you're young. It's very difficult to time these things.
And it's probably best, Chris, for somebody Krista's age, not to sit around and hawk wherever she puts it after she does, right? Because she's not going anywhere. It's not going anywhere.
Right. And then we get to the real question. Where do you put the money? Here's one of the best sources of information that I can give anyone is by Burton Malkiel, and it's The Random Walk Guide to Investing. Very short book. And what the recommendation is going to be is you're going to go with some index funds.
Chris, what's an index fund for those of us who don't know?
What an index fund is, we always hear about things like the Standard & Poor's 500, the 500 largest corporations in America. What an index fund does, you always match the performance of that Standard & Poor's 500. Or let's say the index is the Russell 3000, 3,000 largest companies, publicly traded companies in America. You always do as well as the Russell 3000. So in other words, you're matching an index. You're not paying for a professional money manager to pretend that they're a hedge fund gunslinger and that they can outguess the market.
So you get the ups and downs of the markets without the same sort of involvement day-to-day that you would have if you were buying and trading the stock.
You get the ups and downs of markets without paying for a professional money manager, and you get very low fees. And here's the way to think about those fees, because fees matter. Your average fee on an index fund, less than a tenth of a percent, maybe less than a 20th of a percent. Average fee for actively managed mutual fund, 1.5%. 1.5% compounded over 30 years is a lot of money compared to a tenth of a percent.
Oh, that's great.
Krista, does that help you at all, I hope?
It does. It's just, like I said, it's hard when you don't know a lot about any of this, and I'm trying to negotiate through it. So I appreciate all your help. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Whether or not you have a baby or a new business, you're probably very busy, but you shouldn't be too busy to ask us a question. It's quick and it's easy. Give us a call at 1-877-275-6669. That's 1-877-ASK-MONY. Or you can visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, Chris, our last email today comes from the nation's capital. Sarah is writing in from Washington, D.C. She's apparently been watching her father-in-law try to sort out the stocks his father owned before he passed away about a year ago. He refuses to hire an attorney to help him, so at times he's completely overwhelmed, understandably. Sarah is the custodian for her grandmother's money, and she wants to know some of the basic things to keep in mind so she can avoid her father-in-law's situation. So, Chris, how does Sarah track down documentation or proof of ownership for the stocks that her grandmother owns?
Well, this is the thing we were talking about earlier in the show, sitting down with your grandmother and raising the conversation and saying, okay, where are the documents for the home and the stocks and any retirement accounts or annuities? I mean, you just have to have that conversation. Hopefully, grandma has it fairly organized. But that's how you start it out. And it's not one conversation, it's several. And you're working with your grandmother in order to bring order to this estate.
It's very uncomfortable to have to ask one of your elders about their financial situation, even if they've put you in charge of it. But as we've talked about many times on the show before, you do need to confront those questions.
You do. And by the way, there is an answer that can come back that some people don't like, and it's perfectly valid. Grandma can say, none of your business. It's all well organized. When I pass away, here's the box. You don't have anything to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the case, that's how it can be handled. For most people, it makes a lot of sense really to have a conversation. And most parents do want to get their children involved because they're very aware of all the issues that can come once they've passed. And then you're dealing with estate issues.
Right, right. What does Sarah need to know about capital gains, estate taxes, and inheritance taxes? We talked a little bit about this before with houses, but what about the rest?
Well, it depends how much hair she wants to have. It's very easy to pull your hair out with this whole situation with estate taxes. For most people, the estate tax is a non-issue. For 2007, the taxable amount that we're talking about is above $2 million.
We should all be so lucky.
We should all be so lucky. So that's the first thing is in terms of, do you have to worry about an estate tax? Some states also have an inheritance tax. The way capital gains taxes work is that if you inherit property from your grandmother and it comes to you, you actually don't have to pay capital gains at that point. So there's a lot of tax complications once we get into the estate tax issue. I would simply say break down and hire yourself an estate tax lawyer at that point.
And that raises another question that Sarah asked us to ask you, which is Sarah liable as the custodian for her grandmother's money once the grandmother does pass away for any sort of tax or liability that she might incur?
The estate is on the hook. Sarah is not on the hook. I really do think if you are concerned about estate taxes, it does make sense to work with a lawyer so that you can then work with your grandmother. Things can go smoothly for you and your family.
So just because I'm the executor doesn't mean that I personally have to pay out of my own pocket the bills.
You're not liable for the sense that you have to write a check, but you are expected to be responsible.
Gotcha. That's all the questions we can take on this week's show, but you can leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. Call 1-877-275-6669. That's 1-877-ASK-MONY, or you can visit our contact page on our website, marketplace.org, and we'll see if Chris can help you out. All right, Chris, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Coming up, a dating service pairs ladies who want to be babied with sugar daddies.
It is shameless, but it's also brutally honest.
Prepare your outraged emails, plus free information about how to get free information on your cell phone. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Lisa Napoli, in for Tess Vigeland. Now, on this show, we talk about all kinds of great ways to earn and invest money. This next story details a method we don't necessarily advise, but that doesn't mean people aren't doing it. It's a website for prospective sugar daddies and the people who want them, seekingarrangement.com. Reporter Sean Cold looked into it. By the way, this story isn't appropriate for young children.
Over the past 8 months, a guy named Michael in Toronto has dated 30 women through seekingarrangement.com. That's like one a week, sometimes two on the same date. He's 43.
How often do the dates get sexual?
Well, I'm pretty blunt about saying that that's what I'm looking for.
You'll be shocked to learn that he didn't want his last name used. Michael's a photographer. He's done work for magazines like Playboy and Maxim, and originally he just went on the site to find more camera fodder.
I had always heard my models talking about their sugar daddies, and these girls can be quite mercenary and talking about, yeah, he gave me a car last week, I'm going to Vegas next week.
But Michael says it's not like that with him and the sugar babies he dates from the site. Many of them just want to find a guy who's not a leech, who can pay for dinner. He's not into gold diggers.
I'm turned off, I would say, by a woman who approached me on this site and say, essentially, okay, how much is my allowance?
And that happens a lot on Seeking Arrangement. It's like a dating site from Planet Capitalism. The daddies have to categorize their net worth. Michael picked the $10 to $50 million range. He's made some good investments. And they have to pick a monthly dating budget.
Mine is $10,000 to $20,000.
The sugar babies say how much they expect per month, though a lot of them choose open, amount negotiable. Also, many of these women are freakishly good-looking and surprisingly underdressed. The daddies tend to be older, pictured in luxurious settings or, in one case, shaking hands with former President Clinton.
Yes, and it is shameless, but it's also brutally honest.
Brandon Wade created Seeking Arrangement a little over a year ago. About 100,000 members have signed up. 20 or 30 girls for every guy, though there are male sugar babies on the site too and some sugar mommies. Daddies and mommies pay $39 a month. Babies don't have to pay. All in all, the site makes about $1 million a year.
I think in a society like ours where, you know, some people might say, well, you know, this is not the ethically correct or morally correct thing to do. At the same time, it's a refreshing thing to be able to be honest and to say, this is the thing I'm looking for.
You see phrases like, if you're willing to play, I'm willing to pay. You spoil me and I'll spoil you. Mutually beneficial relationships are nothing new, but they were usually a lot less shouty. And of course, when money enters a conversation about dating and intimacy, business can get pretty snuggly with pleasure. Take this one sugar baby that Brandon told me about.
She requires her sugar daddies to sign a six-month contract because she doesn't want to be involved with somebody and then have them dump her after a few months and she's left with really nothing.
Doesn't that smack of prostitution in some way?
Well, actually, you know, the line is gray, but at the same time, it's also extremely clear.
Michael, the sugar daddy, articulates this a little better.
Hookers, for the most part, don't go rollerblading with their clients like I just did last weekend with someone I met from the site.
And Brandon Wade says he spends a lot of time policing the site for escorts. Out-and-out soliciting isn't allowed, he says. However, a few non-escort sugar babies will say things like, I don't meet for free. One of them requires a $2,500 deposit. She calls it a deposit, before she'll go on a four-day trip with you, which is questionable even to one of the other sugar babies, whose screen name is Damsel in Distress.
So can you call me Damsel?
Sure, I'll call you Damsel.
Yay!
Damsel's experience on Seeking Arrangement is pretty atypical. After browsing the site for a month or so, she got a three-day eviction notice from her landlord. So she posted a profile that was basically just a plea for help.
And people came forward, and I made $6,800 in less than 5 days.
What?
And I didn't meet anybody. They didn't want to meet me.
But a lot of the guys on the site aren't nearly as chivalrous, she says.
They're more demanding than on regular sites, on regular dating sites. They start off right away asking for pictures, headshots, I want full length, I want to see what you're about. You know, like, these guys know that the women are there for money, and they are willing to do things that, you know, they wouldn't otherwise do maybe on like a regular site.
Nonetheless, Damsel thinks Seeking Arrangement is a great idea. She says there should be a place where you can just put it all out on the table.
I'm just going to put it out on the table.
Like Michael did when planning a dinner date with a 21-year-old model. He told her,
what I would like to do after that is take you to a hotel that's nearby and play. That was the euphemism for sex.
But that still doesn't seem like pay for play to you?
Well, it was dinner. I mean, I would take this woman out for dinner any night of the week that she was free. I mean, I it was a bit of an ego trip for me just to be seen with her. I mean, this is the same girl that people see in their local catalogs and on billboards in the city and that sort of thing. So
Michael knows he probably wouldn't have had a shot with her if he wasn't rich. Then again, he says that model eventually told him that she never would have slept with him if she thought he was ugly. I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over 1 billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
Just having health insurance isn't a guarantee that you'll get the care you need. Enter a new kind of service, private health advocates. Lauren Young is with Business Week. She's covered the subject, and she's had some personal experience with them. Lauren, who are these advocates, and what do they do?
A jack of all trades of your healthcare services, a nanny of your healthcare services. The way you get it is if your company is kind enough to pay for it. So there are actually private services out there now that you can go and contract somebody to do this for you. But more companies are offering this as a benefit to their employees. Typically, it costs between $2 and $3 per month per employee.
What's in it for the companies to spend that kind of money?
The reason why companies are offering this is because trying to figure out your way through the whole medical maze is such a huge time suck. We spend hours on the phone. I have personally, but anybody I talk to who's had any insurance problem, it takes hours to get to the right person and figure it out. And it's a huge loss of productivity. So companies realize that this is something that's going to get you doing your job instead of sitting at your computer or on voicemail trying to figure all these things out.
And also, I would imagine it offsets the diminished benefits that all of us are seeing at various companies. Those of us who are lucky enough to have employee-sponsored health care are seeing all kinds of things changing all the time.
It's definitely offsetting some of the diminished benefits, but what's also happening, a big trend right now, is that companies are pushing healthcare decisions on to the end user, onto you, the employee. So you're left making a lot of the decisions, and it's hard to figure out if you go to Hospital X, is it going to be a better deal for you than if you go to Hospital Y to have open heart surgery? I mean, no one wants to be making these decisions, and I don't think any of us are equipped to do that.
Now, I understand that you became intimately acquainted with this concept of health advocates because you had a personal situation with one.
Basically, I always joke that Business Week, it should be called like My Week magazine because it's all about stuff that happens to us. And then we figure, oh, if it's happening to us, it must be happening to other people, too. I had an issue with our insurance company because my son needed plastic surgery. He was born with a giant mole on his back, a very rare thing. Increased risk of cancer, but really the reason to remove it is cosmetic. And it wasn't the cosmetic issues that I had problems with the insurance. It was just the way that the doctor was coding it. The insurance kept rejecting it again and again. And I don't know anything about codes. And I spent, I think it was a ridiculous amount of time, maybe 90 hours of my time, which is, you know, almost more than 2 weeks at work. And I became aware of health advocates. And I just went to my employer and said, you know what, this would be a really valuable service for other people at the company so they don't get stuck doing what I've done. And that's basically how it all got started. And now my company has just added it as a benefit to all 20,000 employees.
Wow. And hopefully you won't have to use it again soon. I assume your son's okay.
Oh, yeah. And luckily, I mean, it was cosmetic and we're all done with that, thank goodness. But it's already stressful enough to have a child going through anything medical. It could be having their tonsils out. But whatever it is, the added stress of dealing with insurance. I mean, I had like eye tics, insomnia. I was a mess. So I'm so happy to have it behind me now.
I've had to deal with that coding thing, too. It's kind of crazy because they assume that you understand their jargon. And of course, why would you? You don't work for their company. But the thing that worries me, Lauren, is I don't love the idea that somebody's collecting all this data about me anyway. And here's one more person who I'd be sort of taking in my confidence to sort of divulge my personal medical situations to. Does anybody worry about that with these health advocates?
I think a lot of people worry about that. The way it used to work in the old days, if you were having a problem with your insurance company and you weren't getting anywhere, a lot of people just called the human resources department at their company and say, can you help me? And the HR people really don't want to be helping you anymore because of privacy issues. So actually, this separates them from you. And it's good because it can't be used against you. Like, my son had all the surgery. What if I got fired? And then I could turn around and say, well, you fired me because I was spending all my time fighting with the insurance company. But there is some concern because who's paying for it in the end? It's the employer. And are you going to be steered into a lower cost option that may not be the best option for you? Maybe you're sent to a heart hospital. I don't know. That's going to be able to do open heart surgery 100 miles away. I'm making an extreme example. But I haven't come across any cases like that. And I did talk to a lot of companies. And so far, the employees that I've spoken to and the employers seem very happy. But who knows, down the line, this could morph into something that could be a little bit more controversial and questioned. But for now, I actually think it's a great option for employees.
Lauren Young is the personal business editor of Business Week. Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts
is
say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
looks like it's going to be the best quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It is time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. Chris, it's October.
Huh?
Traditionally a spooky time for investors, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
That 1987 stock market crash happened in October. I remember that one. Same thing happened in 1997. Then, of course, there was that little market dip back in October 1929.
Exactly. Now, for the record, Lisa, we do get through most Octobers just fine. Still, I think most of us, how should I put it, have market turmoil on the brain.
Sure.
Because we just went through a mini stock market crisis in August.
You counseled people last time around not to do anything rash with their portfolios after such volatility, right?
Yep. And with the magic of tape, you can hear my exact words. You're a long-term investor. You don't know what Mr. Market's going to do. Take this as a wake-up call. Are you diversified properly? Now, I'm comfortable with the way I am, so I'm not going to do anything. I stand by that statement. But Lisa, here's the straight story. The best advice I can give during a market squall is to stay pat. But now that relative calm has returned, go ahead and make adjustments to your portfolio. That is, if you must.
What do you mean by if I must? What would make me want to not make adjustments right now?
All right. Think of August as a learning experience, because we've all seen that brochure that says invest to your risk tolerance drives me nuts. What does that mean?
What does that mean?
Exactly. I mean, I don't like to drive fast, but I once drove a NASCAR car around a racetrack. Now, I really like doing that. Well, when we go through something like August or the 1987 stock market crash, these are learning experiences where you really do find out, well, I'm too much in stocks. Or you might come out of that and say, markets go up, markets go down, I can sleep at night, no problem. If you came out of that experience with some real information that your portfolio is wrong, then go ahead and make adjustments.
But that's the $500 billion question, isn't it? That's...
You could probably make it trillions if you
right,
want.
Right, right.
How do you know?
How do I know what's wrong? Are you saying if I don't have the stomach to deal with the volatility, get out?
Yes. Here's what it is. You know, I had a conversation, it's probably now about a decade ago. It was Paul Samuelson, Nobel laureate, and, you know, really in many ways the godfather of why all of us invest in stocks these days for the long haul. And he said, you know, my mother never invested in the stock market. She only invested in savings accounts, CDs, treasuries. And he said she did the exact right thing. She invested in what she could deal with and understand. Mm-hmm. Again, it's a learning experience, but you make these adjustments not when the market is in a panic and you're selling at some sort of low price, but more importantly, you're sort of in the grips of your emotions as opposed to the grips of reason.
But there are people out there who want to be mini Jim Cramers and time everything perfectly.
Yeah.
What do you say to people like that?
You can't. It's like people keep asking me, is now the time to buy the housing market? Should I be buying now? Is it bottom? You really can't. So my basic answer is overall, you know, create a core portfolio. You don't change it. If you want to be Jim Cramer and yell out booyah, you know, at the top of your lungs at your computer screen, where you click that mouse because you bought or sold something, booyah, 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 you know, take a little tiny portion of your portfolio. Do it in your taxable account, because if it turns out you're wrong, which you probably will be, you can write it off on your taxes. Have some fun with what, 1% of your money? 5% of your money, but for the rest of it, let's focus on diversification and then let's stick with it.
I'm going to take my 1% mad money and do something other than play the markets, that's for sure. So, Chris, what from October 29, October 87, what's the lesson?
The lesson is over the past 400 years, we've had a lot of these crashes. The gut instinct of every investor is to get out. So what I really take away from it is these things happen. When they do happen, let the big boys play it out. Let the hedge funds and the private equity and the quant jocks and all that, let them play around. And then later on, you can go ahead and make some adjustments if that's what you've learned.
All right. That's the straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Lisa.
Tell me you haven't had this experience. You're looking for a particular restaurant. You want to call for directions, but you don't know the phone number. So you give in and dial three little numbers on your cell phone, 411. Reluctantly, because those 411 information calls can cost as much as $2 a piece. Vern Kopitoff is a business reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. He says there are some new alternatives.
You call the 1-800 number, you listen to an ad or two, and an automated voice recognition program tries to provide you with the number you're seeking, all for free.
Which is not to say they're problem-free. For a Chronicle article this week, Copy Toff took three of these services out for a test dial.
There's a broad variation in quality. The voice recognition services sometimes understand, sometimes don't. In some cases, they may just simply pass you on to a human-powered operator when everything else fails.
Which they invariably did under CopyToff's voice recognition tests.
For instance, I used my name as a tongue twister, and every service I tested failed.
At the end of the day, though, there was one clear winner. Same one as always.
I found that the Google 411 worked the best. It provided me with business listings I wanted with minimal hassle and offered to connect me on the spot. The problem with the Google service, though, is that it only does provide business listings. There are no residential listings at this point.
The good news? No ads, which CopyToff says can be a blessing given the quality offered on some services.
One of the ads started with the line, "Have you heard the one about the porn star and the parrot?"
I'll pay the $2. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, what can a family do on their own to save the planet? When there's a will, there's a way.
My husband and I have decided to spend the whole year not buying any brand new consumer items.
Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Lisa Napoli. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.